show him no respect. Middle name, price tag, first name, gotcha. Start a slow, got on a roll, now they can't stop ya. Talking about, hey boo, how you do? Some clown uptown said you ran through his crew. I give you props and your credit cause it's due. But I ain't that clown and my crew ain't that crew. Time's too hard to be faking like I'm dating on some staking. Whining and dining, I ain't tricking on no chicken. Leave it up to me, I close the whole damn store on ya. I got nothing but love for you. H-E-A-V, Y-D, don't test me, don't ask me for nothing, for Nathan's, for death, for Doodly Squad, you can do me not, you plan on plot, on who be hot and trying to hit the slot, I know your low pro style, your low ho profile, kick a brother in the gut and then you smile, I must admit, I really dig your operation, every time we on the phone, you got the sexy conversation, so now you hope to be the woman of my dream, and while I'm sleeping, you be creeping, robbing me clean, I see you hanging on the corners with the rest of your girl crew, standing by the gutter with your booty cutters, so who's the honey dip, down with the bunny grip, always got and setting up a trap with the sex. I got nothing but love for you, baby.
What you got?
I got nothing but love for you, honey.
Yeah, what else?
I got nothing but love for you, baby.
Uh-huh.
I got nothing but love for you, honey.
Yeah, what else?
I got nothing but love for you, baby.
What you got?
I got nothing but love for you, honey.
Yeah, what else?
I got nothing but love for you, baby.
Uh-huh.
I got nothing but love for you, honey.
Yeah, whatever.
No bother, don't know bother, this the jumper, yeah. No bother, don't know bother, this the jumper, yeah. No bother, don't know bother, this the jumper, yeah.
Skinny, that's that Noxema.
Don't forget my groove, man.
Listen up, fellow students, readers, and patrons of the UBC Bookstore. This upcoming November 27th, our beloved bookstore is hosting their very own Res Night for all UBC students. They'll be treating you to a night of free snacks to keep that brain fed, gaming, music courtesy of DJ Ochre, and need I mention, crazy discounts on books and supplies. Watch me be there stacking up on pencil cases. We're kicking the night off at 5 p.m., and for more info, check out the website at bookstore.ubc.ca.
Are you a current UBC grad student? If so, then listen up, because the Graduate Student Society lets UBC grads book rooms and spaces in the newly renovated grad student building. Be sure to take advantage of what the facility has to offer. The rooms come equipped with sound systems and can host up to 300 people. Even better, as grad students, you don't have to pay booking fees. Not a grad? Don't worry. The Tia Corner House is open to the public, as in the Corner Pub, opening earlier next year. For more information, contact booking manager Rob at bookings@gss.ubc.ca.
Good evening and welcome to UBC Arts on Air, a bi-weekly program focusing on unique faculty and students in arts. And my name is Ira Nadell. Today we're talking to Marjorie Fee, editor of the journal Canadian Literature and professor of English. And with interests in language, Aboriginal studies, and Canadian writing, Marjorie is a literary triple threat. Greetings.
Oh, thank you so much, Ira.
Well, let's begin with that question of varied interests. I mean, would you say that your research in these fields has evolved, or did you basically leave one and then pick up another?
Well, I think it's a highly developed form of procrastination. So, you know, if you stick with one field and get bored and don't want to do something, you can just shift to the other one. So that's my explanation for why I'm doing so many things. But how did it happen? When I was at Glennon College, which is part of York University as an undergraduate, every year they had a conference. And so the first year I was there, they had a conference on Quebec literature and separatism, of course, and there was René Lévesque. And the next year, when I was involved and got to do some of the organizing, Harold Cardinal turned up. So some of my interest, I think you can trace back right to that first year. And I think the Canadian nationalism was just everywhere. And so we were all elbows out. Why do we have to take this dumb Milton when we could be reading...
Susanna Moody.
Susanna Moody, right, who was certainly his equal in every respect. So, you know, we got very political about some of those things. And so all of those interests come out of the politics, really, that I was exposed to in my first, in all my years at university.
So that seemed to be a period when politics and Canadian literature were certainly allied or connected.
Right, right.
And was that kind of pulled you into Canadian literature as opposed to, you know, a more conventional approach is I took two seminars and I really found the writing of X was so marvelous, E.J. Pratt, that I decided I'm going to devote my life to The Last Spike. It wasn't quite that way.
It wasn't that simple, no. Well, there weren't many courses because it wasn't taught. And I did take courses in Quebec literature and French, actually. I have more memories of those because the professors were all so engagés. So really, we were, I think in fourth year, I had a half course in Canadian English and a half course in Canadian literature. And I was a Blake fanatic. I spent most of my time reading William Blake. So the fact that I ended up in Canadian literature it wasn't an accident, but it really was a time when I graduated in 1971. Well, Survival was published in 1972. So you can see it was just a gleam in Margaret Atwood's eye, really.
And that's the time universities are beginning to wake up.
Right.
To Canadian studies, mm-hmm. to Canadian literature. So I think it's a critical time, isn't it?
Right. And York was a pretty happening place, and we were working as students on a project. I wish I could remember the name. About Canadian literature, literary publishing, and we did a bibliography. We looked at where Canadian literature was being taught. And that came out of the Canadian literature course as a sort of research project. And so we did a lot of agitating and fact-finding. And then I ended up doing some kind of wonderful government-subsidized bibliography of Canadian literature, an annotated bibliography of Canadian fiction. Now, to find the books, we had to go and sit on the floor in the library and just pull them off one by one, or sneak into Beth Appledorn's bookstore and kind of scan the shelves desperately, because there was no way to find any of that out.
So it's quite interesting that your interests and the development of the field, both in a scholarly and non-scholarly fashion, occurred almost simultaneously.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that was the case for other people. But when I got to do my PhD at Toronto, things were a little bit less gung-ho there, even though Robinson Davies was there as the master of Massey College, and Claude Bissell, who was interested in Canadian literature, was a big figure in the university, a president for a while. It was still a little bit slow to catch on. And the one funny thing was when I wanted to do my PhD thesis, I was told, well, you cannot do it on a living author. Right? So, you know, you think, why not? And it's because they might write something else and your whole thesis would be blown out of the water. And of course, you know, for a while I thought, oh, assassinate Margaret Atwood. But then I ended up doing a literary historical thesis, which was much more acceptable.
Okay. And now you find yourself editing the journal Canadian Literature. And frankly, what does that mean besides writing a lot of rejection letters?
Oh, we practically have those automated. No, I'm joking. I do write the rejection letters by, you know, personally. What does it mean? Well, it means coping with the transition from a print world, world where people mailed everything in. When I started as editor, we got 3 copies mailed into us. 2 of those copies went out to readers by mail, right? And now they upload their file onto our system. I edit by downloading and doing track changes and uploading it again for my assistant to go. You know, it's just changed that fast.
Okay, that's pretty much, yes, the practice. But I'm interested because in the thematic numbers, the fact that
issues have frequently and
very distinctively been devoted to a particular topic, Canadian life writing, for example, native writing.
Right.
How does that happen? Tell us a little bit about the role of the editor.
You mean
in
you're
all
actually
this.
Interested in the content of
yes,
the journal?
Not surprisingly.
Well, you know, when you're the editor, that's sort of nice. You know, you sort of think, oh, what a great article, and you're happy about it. But really, it's the production of the issues. But anyway, special issues, well, sometimes people propose them to us. The next issue, not the next issue, but the issue after that is going to be an issue on First Nations writing. It was an accident. We're just getting more and more submissions, and we sort of had a whole issue come in and get accepted, which is very nice when you can do that. Sometimes people want to guest edit on a theme that doesn't pull in enough articles, and then you don't have an issue. These are the kinds of mind-bogglingly strange little things that no one thinks of when it comes out with a name on it. They don't think about that. So the issue that just came out is on early Canadian, new directions in early Canadian writing. And that's good to
So is that the biggest challenge in editing a journal? That is to say, shaping an issue so that it reflects either tremendous unity or its opposite, tremendous diversity?
Well, no, it's much more banal. Getting 6 articles through peer review every quarter, right? It's an uneven kind of pipeline, and so sometimes you'll be sitting waiting for that article to be peer reviewed and accepted so you can put it in the issue. You know, and so it's a little more random than it sounds, and often we have to push special issues along to wait for that last article to get revised. People get pregnant at the most inconvenient times. It's just not as organized as I thought it would be when I took the job on.
Now, the first editor was George Woodcock, who, interestingly, I know his 100th birthday is being celebrated this month. Did he have a particular vision for the journal, do you think? I mean, we're going back to 1959, when it started.
Yeah. Well, he was an anarchist, so I think that really underpinned his notion that there should be no coterie or theoretical perspective imposed on what came into the journal. I think he had a notion that what came in should be well written. And one thing he did a lot more of back in the day was ask writers to write pieces on how they wrote, or, you know, more personally, personal perspectives, I guess, from writers. We don't do that so much. We've done it occasionally, but it's not so common.
No, that's true. I remember the early issues where, indeed, there was a sort of autobiographical account by a poet, a novelist about process, which I always find quite fascinating.
Right.
Because I see that others have issues, you know, in terms of how to get it done. And those pieces were really quite fascinating. But given Woodcock's own interests in nonfictional writing and creative writing, it seems, now that you mention it, almost a natural step that he would transfer that interest into the journal.
Mm-hmm. And we publish poetry, which isn't all that common for academic journals, and it's a lovely resource. We use that poetry. We're working on something now as a teaching and learning resource that will be on the internet called CanLit Guides, and one of the things we use to support that is the poetry that we have the rights to, because it was published in the journal. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see the kinds of poetry that came in. I was startled to discover that Joyce Carol Oates published quite a bit of poetry in the journal. I didn't know she was Canadian, but I think she worked in Canada for a while, maybe, or something like that.
I think she might have taught at the University of Windsor or something of that sort for a while. And we should also mention that As part of the Woodcock celebration that very evening on November 22nd, Margaret Atwood will be here on campus and will be speaking at the Chan Center. I know that you recently traveled to India and I think lectured or talked about Canadian studies, Canadian literature there. What was the reaction and what was the interest? Did you discover people hadn't heard much about it or quite the opposite?
Well, what they were really interested in, the women who invited me there, Malashri Lal is one of them, and she's a professor of English, was more oral literatures and indigenous literatures. So they were starting to work with indigenous people in India and their oral production. And so it was more of a discussion about the ethics, the methods in Canada. And I don't know anything about India, so I had to talk about my own work and the kinds of concerns that people raise about reading oral texts once they've been transcribed or translated or even rudely appropriated by some colonizing force. You know, all of those issues really aren't, you know, they haven't got to that stage in thinking about, they haven't been thinking about it for as long as we have, I guess. So.
Were there Canadian texts available? Did you notice Canadian poetry or novels?
Well, they do read it and teach Canadian literature to some degree. I certainly worked on a thesis committee where the woman was writing on Margaret Atwood, for example. You know, it's the sort of the obvious names that they know. And of course, Indian publishing is fabulous. They'll put out a book in 10 minutes and it'll be $2. So people in India read a lot and almost huge numbers of books are accessible and so on. I don't know that they're as web-oriented as we are yet. Yeah.
But it's coming. It's coming.
Oh, for sure. Everybody has a phone. Everybody.
On that note, we'll pause for a short break. Well, thanks for rejoining us here, UBC Arts on the Air with Marjorie Fee. And I want to turn to your interest in Aboriginal studies and culture. Did that develop out of a particular experience or event? Or again, it was something, as you think back of your relationship with the country and generally Canadian studies, seemed to emerge?
Well, I told you about the conference where Harold Cardinal was the speaker, but of course the idea of literature wasn't really in my mind. He had written The Unjust Society, which was a book about Pierre Trudeau's notion that somehow just making Aboriginal people like everybody else would be a good move. Didn't work out so well. And I remember picketing some government confab, which was organized by that conference. But I didn't. I mean, Canadian literature wasn't known at that point. You'd say, oh, I'm studying Canadian literature, and people would look at you like, well, was there any? Is there any? Really, it was vestigial. So I didn't really start thinking about Aboriginal literature until I got to, I was at the University of Victoria, and I started to teach distance education, and they had a distance course. It was really aimed at Aboriginal students. They were trying to get more of them to do English and become teachers. So I started to teach that, and really even then, not all the books were Canadian, so we taught Jeanette Armstrong's Slash, we taught In Search of April Rain Tree by Beatrice Culleton, who now calls herself Beatrice Culleton Moissonnier, and it might have been a Thompson Highway play in there, I'm not sure. So it was still, and some poetry. But the other works were American. So we taught Silco and The Way to Rainy Mountain. And so I got interested, and then I started to work at the for Camosun College at the Friendship Center, teaching a course for Indigenous students. So I got to meet these students who were being upgraded, sometimes a little forcibly, and it was a very big experience for me. It was very interesting to meet them and to find out what they did and did not want to read.
But so I think your most current work has taken you into the area of genetics. Genomics.
Genetics.
Can you explain, please?
It's another big,
English professor?
Form of procrastination.
Genetics? We need to know.
I don't do genetics. I just read about it. Well, what happened was that my dear colleague, Sneja Gunev, had been working on a project on food, and she wanted me to join up. And we had actually taught a course on cannibalism, literary cannibalism. It's all over the place. You know, Grimm's fairy tales, witches are always eating nummy little children, and so on and so forth. So we had taught that course, but she said, if you want to join this project, you can't do cannibalism. It's just too hard for the social science assessors, grant assessors, to get their heads around. They just think it's weird. And so I thought, well, I'll do obesity, because there are lots of fat people in literature, too. And in fact, Lady Oracle was one of my favorite Atwood novels. We keep coming back to Atwood, but she is coming. Anyway, so I love Lady Oracle, and I wrote a little book about it. And Lady Oracle, the woman in that novel, Joan Foster, loses about 100 pounds. So, you know, I thought, oh, this could go somewhere. And then I ran into the idea that somewhere I was hit by the notion that Aboriginal people are supposedly more susceptible to type 2 diabetes than non-Aboriginal people. In fact, than white people, because lots of different nationalities have this increased susceptibility. And what I found out after reading all this genetics, because they were looking for the gene that explained it, was that this is rubbish. And in fact, the explanation is that the group that they were studying, the Pima Indian, and I think they're living in Arizona, are just poor, and they eat bad food, and that causes diabetes. Now everybody, I think, has got a bit of a grip on that, but there was this long study that kind of saw them as, you know, susceptible and vulnerable because of some gene that was there to be found. They haven't really found it.
So this work has taken you really into a kind of interdisciplinary area, is that right? Where you're looking at the culture, you're looking at some of the literature?
Well, what it got me into was science studies. And I really went off to look at text. That's what I was doing. I was reading scientific texts and thinking about how they were reinscribing discourses of racialization. So I was kind of a long way from literature, but now I'm back teaching science fiction and science studies. And so literature is back in the picture. I'm sure much to everyone's relief.
Well, I don't know.
Well, I am an English professor.
I realize that. And you've always had this long-standing interest in language, linguistics, of course, literature, and you're very involved with the Dictionary of Canadian English on Historical Principles. Now, can you describe this dictionary, and why is it important?
Well, of course it's important. All dictionaries are important. But this dictionary was published in 1967, and no one had touched it for year after year after year. And I knew about this because another accidental thing happened to me. I was hired at Queen's University to produce a guide to Canadian usage. And this was a big database project. Again, you know, what did I know about this? I had actually taken a diploma in applied linguistics. So I was thrown into this semi-social scientific work and finished that. But when I got here, a young Austrian postdoc turned up in my department, and he had been made the editor-in-chief of the Dictionary of Canadianisms on Historical Principles by the publishers, who wanted to do a new edition. So I had to join up because I thought this was just so important. And so we're putting in all kinds of words that are distinctively Canadian or important to Canadians, and it's fascinating to find out that Cremo is a BC-ism, for instance, is pretty important, I think.
So is this dictionary organized in a way similar to the Oxford English Dictionary? In other words, if I look up the meaning of a particular word online,
right,
I will find its original usage first, and then there might be three entries leading me to the present?
That's right. And what we've done so far is just get that first book onto the web. And we have permission now from the publishers to make it open access, and we're going to launch it in January.
That's very exciting. But tell me, is there a geographical component? In other words, is it envisioned that there could be a link to regions in the country or provinces in the country that distinctly have introduced that particular term,
yes.
a term from Nova Scotia
yes.
or whatever? So I could look at a map or even
yes.
a county or a region.
Well, that's very nice to have the idea of a county. We're not right down to the county level, because what we're using are generally speaking, newspapers to find out what variation there is across the country. Not exclusively newspapers, but quite generally. But what we can do is we can upload regional charts that show you that CREMO, again, it sounds a little strange, but it's a distinctive term, is mostly used in BC, and then a little bit in Alberta and not in the rest of the country. And then there are lots of words in other parts of the country that don't make it all the way out to British Columbia as well. And then there are words that all Canadians use. People don't realize that parkade is pretty Canadian, and emerge for emergency, tensor bandage. You know, there are lots of ordinary words that we didn't notice weren't being used anywhere else in the world.
So do you find that new words are constantly being introduced, or I hesitate to use the word, but invented?
Well, of course they are. That's how language works. We can't always keep track of them. But I have to say the internet makes it easy to find them if you know what they are. The big problem is how do you find a new word if you don't know it exists? So people have to notice it and bring it to your attention.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So I want to know from you, if you had to choose, we've been talking about three very distinct areas of interest for you, academically, professionally, personally, but if you had to choose a single area of research and you had a year to pursue it, what would it be?
Oh, dear.
Just to put you on the spot.
Well, I'm just finishing a literary book on land claims and Canadian literature. So my next project is going to be on, it's called From Bones to Genes, the racialization of Native American bodies. Because what I discovered in my work on genetics is that whenever a new discovery, a new hormone, or blood types, or if we think back to skulls, any time there's some kind of new scientific interest in some part of the body that's supposed to be distinctive, the instant reaction is to go and find out how it's connected to so-called race. And you can just predict it. And because people really believe in racial difference, even though it's genetics shows us that it's not there, people keep trying to find it in the body. So I think that's a pretty fascinating topic. I don't know that I'll be reading any literature for that. I could. I think it'll be back to
the
science.
You just used
text.
The word, yes, predict. I mean, do you want to make any predictions in terms of 5 or 10 years, how any of these areas might look, whether it's Canadian literature, in terms of research, in terms of how we are approaching them, whether it's Aboriginal studies, Canadian literature, or even Canadian English? Do you, for example, see a much greater integration?
Well, I think people are sort of past that. We're post-nationalist in some ways, and so why we're interested in Canadian English, it arose from just our feeling that we wanted to be distinctive. We wanted to show that Canada had a distinctive variety of English, right? But now it's very interesting that world English is the way it is, and each English goes its own merry way. And so now that we have documented all these different varieties of English, they have dictionaries, they're online, we can actually sit down and shift from one to the other. The Dictionary of Newfoundland English is online if you're really interested in that variety. So I think what people are going to be doing is much more global comparative work. And I welcome that, because I think nationalism, it's too narrow, it's too limiting, and I think a lot of people come to realize it's not that we should abandon nationalism, but we have to think past those notions.
It's sort of the next step, I imagine.
Well, because we can actually find some data.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
This has been tremendously inspiring. I don't know which area I'm going to focus in now, but I obviously have to change direction. I want to thank you, Marjorie, for coming in, providing us a glimpse of the multifaceted life of, indeed, one of UBC's most engaged and active members in the Faculty of Arts. And certainly stay tuned for future UBC Arts on the Air.